Good evening to you all, and welcome to this conversation with Esther Freud and John Tiedemann. The evening is put on by the Rowan Arch Project in partnership with the Freud Museum, the Institute of Psychoanalysis, the Women's Therapy Center, and it's a series which brings together people who are interested in the arts and in psychoanalysis. And this evening, of course, we have Esther Freud, who's a well-known novelist, whose books have spanned a whole lot of child development, adult interactions, and her first book, Hideous Kinky, was made into a film. Her current book, which will be, I suppose, the main focus of the discussion and conversation this evening, is being adapted for television. The conversation will be for about 45 minutes, and then we will have discussions with you from the floor. And then after that, we hope that you will stay and have a glass of wine in the foyer and continue the conversations between yourselves. I'm Marcus Johns. I'm a psychoanalyst, and I'm just chairing the evening. John Tiedemann, who's in conversation with Esther, is a psychoanalyst of many years' experience. And so now I will just hand over to Esther and John. Thank you.
Right. Well, I thought the obvious place to begin this discussion would be with the name Freud, inevitably. Sigmund Freud was your great-grandfather. And to a lot of people who might be here in the audience this evening, the psychotherapists, the psychoanalysts, it's a great name and somebody who's written a lot of theories, a lot of books. So my first question was, how familiar are you with his writings, with his theories, and do you draw on these at all when you write your books?
I think that purposefully I have steered away from studying him. I have read some of his books or dipped into books, but I haven't studied psychoanalysis. I just felt that it would be almost kind of slightly self-conscious to do it because I wasn't doing it out of a natural interest. And it's interesting because I've quite often spoken to various members of my family and found that that has been almost entirely the case with all of them. That people just always want to find their own way and rebel in whatever way it is by just being interested in what they're interested in. Mm-hmm. So maybe that's just come down the generations.
Mm-hmm. Right. Now, to your writings. One of the things that struck me about your writing is that how the ability you've got to sort of conjure up atmosphere, states of mind, and as we know in this book, Love Falls, but also Hideous Kinky, you write through the eyes of the child as though you see the world as the child sees it, in a very evocative way. So coming to this book, which is about adolescence, what prompted you to write this book?
I find myself very, very easily drawn to writing from the points of view of children, although I don't really think of them as being children when I start. I think that they're just a character who happens to be 6 or 17 or 12 or whatever age they are. And I always feel slightly kind of riled on their behalf that they're being classified as children, as if they're all being lumped together, whereas, you know, if, say, Graham Greene, every every hero of his is in their 40s. No one says, oh, another man in their 40s, you know, when will it end? So I feel the same way. I have this idea for a story. The character happens to be this age. I feel there's a lot for me to say from this point of view, because I think really what they're seeing is almost always new, and they're on a discovery. And I really like to investigate that. And I find actually that I have to make a real effort to pull myself into a kind of adult world when I'm writing about adult characters. I think The Sea House, my last book, Before Love Falls, there were no children narrators. And occasionally there were two little girls called Em and Ari. They would creep in, and sometimes they would almost have a voice, and I'd have to sort of push them out again, because I just find it naturally, sort of, it pulls me, and I find it quite easy to do. And yes, I never really thought of Lara as being a child, but certainly she's having a new experience, and that makes a completely different type of writing than somebody who's thinking, okay, I've done this many times, how am I going to live this bit of my life differently, which is something maybe someone in their 40s would have.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder as well, my childhood was so intense, and I thought about it so much while I was even having it, and spent a lot of time trying to kind of unmuddle it for myself as I came out of it. I think that's probably why I feel very drawn to go back into it, and almost it's almost like I need to kind of work it out. Mm-hmm. And sort it out. So it's absolutely sort of an endless source of fascination for me to go back and examine bits of it.
And in this book, examine adolescent experience. Now, I found a quote from William Shakespeare on adolescence this afternoon. I would there were no age between 16 and 23, or that youth would sleep out the rest, for there is nothing in the between but getting wenches with child, wronging the ancient tree, stealing and fighting.
Wow.
So that's perhaps wishing away adolescence, but clearly you haven't wanted to do that. You wanted to explore it, get into it, write about these sort of seminal experiences. Perhaps you'd like to read us a bit, just to give us something of the atmosphere of the book,
yeah,
which perhaps not everybody's familiar with.
Okay. I chose a piece to read, which is about halfway through the book. The book is really, it took me a while to work out what this book was about, but I decided quite near the end that really it's a love story, but it's not just a love story between Lara and the young man that she falls in love with. It's a love story between her and her father, who she gets to know during the course of this story. It's their first summer spent traveling together, on holiday together. She grows up with a very distant father who she's only ever seen for an hour or two at a time. And when she's 17, he asks if she'd like to go on holiday with him. And they find themselves embarking on what becomes a much more complicated holiday than either of them expected. It's set in Tuscany, and they are sort of immersed in a large group of sort of upper-class British people on holiday out there. And at this point, from where I'm going to read, Lara, who's the main character, she's already really infatuated by Kip, who is the son of this neighbouring gentleman. And they've all gone out to the waterfall, where they sometimes go and picnic, the Love Falls of the title. And there's a rather unpleasant kind of showy relative of Kip's called Roland. I think it's probably all you need to know. Just going to read a few pages. Eventually lunch was called, and Kip, blue-veined with hours of cold, flung himself down beside her. Roland stood on her other side and shook himself, and every female around the tablecloth, including Lara, although she was appalled to have done so, squealed. "Who is this man?" Andrew looked up. "I'm your son-in-law." Roland was rubbing at his hair, the muscles of his thighs straining, the sheer black briefs drying in a silhouette around the bulge of his crotch. "The father of your about-to-be-born first grandson?" And he looked out from the soft white of his towel and flashed him a grin. "I don't remember giving my permission," Andrew muttered crossly. and he urged everyone to begin. The food was sumptuous, artichokes and broad beans, plates of prosciutto, asparagus with shavings of parmesan, tomatoes chopped with mozzarella and basil, thick wedges of omelette baked with spinach, cheese and herbs. Lara heaped her plate, wondering how you could build up such an appetite lying, doing nothing, on a rock. And she glanced at Kip, who was wolfing his down like a greyhound. "So tell me," Elizabeth was the first to speak, "is it fearfully dangerous at jumping down that waterfall?" Her question was really for anyone who'd done it, but her eyes swerved round to Roland. "Not at all." Roland had his mouth full and a slice of mozzarella squelched out from the side. "It's the most wonderful fun. Why don't you try it?" "I couldn't possibly," she protested. "I'm much too old, and anyway..." She looked down at the orange halter neck and the deep tanned crevice of her cleavage. Everything would come flying out. "Pamela, my darling," Roland creased his eyes. "How about you?" Pamela shook her head. "I decline," she said formally. But all the same, it was clear she was glad to have been asked. Hugh leant over and reached for a bottle of wine. "We're all too old and cowardly," he said, splashing red into a cup. "You'd better leave us alone." Lara saw her father look up at the cliff. He shifted uneasily, and she felt her stomach contract. "I'll have a go." His eyes were steely, and Lara had to stop herself from calling out. There was a silence while everyone waited for Roland to dissuade him. "You're on," Roland grinned, "but I'll bet you a fiver you don't go through with it." Lambert raised his eyebrows. "We'll see," he said, and he let his hand trail along the length of Isabel's bare arm. "For God's sake, man, let your lunch settle first." Roland spiked a red curl of prosciutto, and he lay back to wait. The remainder of lunch was subdued. Lara ate what she could and regretted having served herself so much. What would happen, she thought, if he got to the lip of the pool and then panicked and had to be helped back down? She glanced across at Isabel, willing her to intervene, but Isabel was busy arguing with Hamish to eat something, urging Hamish to eat something, anything green, even offering to lick the salad dressing off a bean if he'd agreed to try it. All around them, others were eating too. It was the Italian hour for lunch, and families and groups of young people sat like them around a central feast of food. But unlike the Italian families, who accepted that after lunch was a time of repose, Hamish, Allegra, Kip and Antonia threw themselves back into the water as soon as they'd had enough. "Hamish!" Isabel called. "Wait 5 minutes, at least." But in the face of other influences, she let her voice trail off. Lara thought she caught disapproval in the murmuring of women in flowered pinnies and in the half-closed eyes of fathers already preparing for a snooze. Men with short legs and round, taut stomachs. Old men, the same age as Lambert. Lara looked over at her father and saw he had undressed. He was standing, staring at the water, wearing only his blue trunks. His legs looked narrow and pale, but his chest, his neck and arms were strong. "Maybe he will do it," Lara allowed herself to hope, and she purposefully looked away from the vulnerable bald spot on the back of his head. "Right," Roland stood up and stretched, beating a quick tattoo on his full stomach. "Ready when you are." Lambert was already walking away, climbing, navigating the shallow footholds in the rocks that rose steeply to the top. Roland winked at the others. "We have a champion in the making," and he clambered after him. There was silence as everybody watched. "For God's sake," Lara wanted to shout, "leave him alone." But it was impossible to take her eyes off Lambert as he climbed. Lara hardly noticed when Kip stood beside her, couldn't feel the electricity that usually sparked between them. And there he was, standing, silhouetted against the sky. A moment later, Roland stood behind him. So stupid, Lara thought, her heart in her mouth, that he would actually be capable of pushing him off the ledge. "Old fool," Andrew Willoughby muttered. "Go on, then." Lambert began to step out along the rushing stones of the waterfall, his arms outstretched for balance. He stopped in the middle, just as the others had done, and waited. Lara felt sure she could see him, measuring with his eyes, and she thought she heard Roland shouting out instructions to him over the roar. But Lambert didn't look round. "Here he goes," Kip said, forgotten beside her, and it was true. Lambert was leaning forward, his body tensed, and he was falling, shooting out with the spray, his body braced against the torrent, and everyone, for all Lara knew, everyone in the valley gave a cheer. But he wasn't falling like the others. Kip, Roland, even Antonia had leapt out from the water, had jumped rather than been taken, and now she saw her father was falling too close to the cliff. "Shit," Antonia said, and just at that moment he hit the water and disappeared. Like a streak, Roland jumped from above. He hit the water, bobbed back under, and while the others were still paralysed on their rock, he rose to the surface, pulling Lambert with him. Lara ran down to the water. "Dad," she called. "Dad!" Roland had his arm around him. "Bring him up here." Isabel was running with a towel. "I'm perfectly all right." Lambert was limping, and he tried shrugging Roland off, but as his foot touched down, pain shot through him and he nearly fell. "I felt it crack," he said, and he turned away and retched. There was a white gash along the side of his foot, filling up with blood, and his little toe was hanging loosely. "I'm fine," he said again, recovering himself, and he waved away the glass of wine that Elizabeth offered. "I just didn't..." He made a sort of measuring movement with one hand. "I didn't quite clear it." "But almost..." Isabel was beside him, dabbing at the blood with a napkin. "It looked marvellous at first." Lambert leant into her encircling arm. "Yes, it did feel marvellous. Rather like flying and swimming all at the same time." He sank down then on the towel, and Lara, who was sitting by, saw his face was pale. "Is he all right?" she whispered to Isabel as he closed his eyes. She wanted to touch him, to put her hand on his forehead. But that wasn't how it was. "Dad," she whispered instead, "can I get you anything?" But he only moved his lips in a little breath of no. "He's shivering," Pamela said. And relieved to have something to do, the women shook the crumbs from a large soft rug and tucked it over him. "Dad," she whispered urgently. But he answered her only with a faint smile. "He's tough as anything," Andrew said irritably. "It's a shock. Leave him alone. Let him rest." "There's no fool like an old fool, eh?" Hugh shook his head, and with a celebratory pop, he pulled the cork from another bottle of wine. Lambert sat back against a rock, his leg raised a little on a bed of towels. His foot was already starting to swell, puffing pale purple around the toes, and every time he moved it, Lara saw him swallow in a concerted effort to control the pain. What if he'd fallen differently? If he'd hit his head? Broken his neck? Lara felt herself quake, and she thought each time she looked at him that he was paler. The first time it occurred to her, and it seemed idiotic that it never had before, that she knew almost nothing about him. She'd accepted his reserve and refrained from asking even the most natural questions. "Did you have brothers and sisters? What happened to your parents? Why did you never fall in love?" She said it now in their silent conversation. But of course he didn't answer. Why had she been so obedient? Why had she stuck fast to his rules? She put out a hand and touched his shoulder, but he only flinched. "I think we should get him back," Lara said, speaking only to Isabel. And without waiting for the others, she began to gather up their things. "I'll drive you," Isabel agreed. And with Andrew's cold eyes resting on her, they hoisted him up, one on each side, and helped him towards her car. Thanks.
See, I think that captures the book very well, doesn't it? It's very evocative of the... of the powerful forces which are at issue in this book.
I've been told to sit nearer the microphone in case you think it's a very sinister message.
Where was I? Yes. The powerful forces. Now, thinking about this, I agree, it's a love story. And it seems to me that there's certain themes in the book which a psychoanalyst might take an interest in. There's sex, there's death, and there's love. Most importantly, love. And it seems to me it is this development of a loving relationship in lots of different ways, but most particularly between Lara and father. And in that little piece that you've just read, you see perhaps he's felt challenged, and he begins to enter the world of other people that he's trying so hard to stay out of most of the time. And he's the one who says, you know, I've never fallen in love. He says that in conversation. So it's a love story. Is that what you intended when you wrote it?
I didn't intend that. But one of the starting points for the story was being aware when I was around that age of the shifting sort of status between myself and my parents, and that moment when you sort of, at least I accepted as a child, that they were more glamorous, interesting, sought after than me. That's how it was. And then there's a moment around sort of 16, 17, where suddenly that's not always the case. And I found that really quite strange and quite difficult. And I could see that they did too. I was really aware of that. And that's what I was using as the sort of, it was the one thing that I knew I was going to use in the book. The one sort of psychological thing I knew that I was going to use is that she sets off on this journey with her father as somebody lucky to have been asked into this world. And then while she's there, people aren't as interested in him as they usually have been in her experience of being in his company. He is a sort of eminent historian who's much sought after and always trying to sort of, you know, say, no, I can't possibly do that. I'm busy, you know, working. I can't come and, you know, have dinner. Couldn't possibly. And then when they're away from that society in a completely different milieu of people, Lara finds herself much more sought after and popular, and it's uncomfortable for her because it's all shifted about. And that's what I wanted to use. Uh-huh. And I have a little bit in that she feels responsible for him. Even in that section, you can see that she minds what people think of him. She feels responsible. She doesn't want to see him looking a fool. Whereas she's never had to deal with that before. I mean, probably every child goes through that moment where their parents look really, really human to them, where they didn't before.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I thought the progression through the book of how she doesn't know father very well, and, you know, slowly, organically, the relationship grows, and from sharing a bottle of water, and do they wipe the top, you know, or they're more intimate, so to speak, with one another. And I, to my mind, that's the triumph, isn't it? Of that love does, she makes him or helps him become a loving person. And I don't know whether perhaps love falls is also the tear in his eye at the end. But the other thing is thinking about this character, Lara, who gets to know her father and begins to care about him. The person who's not there, as it were, or mentioned in passing, is mother. And it seems to me that mother's, the mother inside of her, as we would put it, is a very good figure, a very loving figure. It allows, to my mind, the fact that there's never any doubt that Lara's going to come through these experiences and find something good out of the bad. And that's because of what she's got inside of her from mother, which is only talked about sort of in passing. Would you agree with that?
I'd never thought of that, but I think I was about halfway through the book when I had written it very much without moving away from the narrative of they are in Italy for 3 weeks and we sort of almost living with them day by day. And after about halfway through the book, I read through it and decided that it was almost too claustrophobic and that there wasn't enough space in it somehow. And so what I decided to do was to give her a background, to give her a past, and I wove in the story of Lara's life with her mother traveling when she was a younger child. And I felt that it would parallel the sort of insular experience of their traveling in Tuscany, which isn't really traveling, it's just sort of moving from one little British isle to another British isle in the heart of Tuscany, with the much more exotic traveling that she'd done with her mother in India. They traveled there on the magic bus and lived with Indians, and went to Buddhist camps, and that was something that was easy for me to write about because it was the experience of one of my oldest friends. And I went and interviewed her and I kind of wove in her stories, some of which I had already known most of my life. But what I realized from what you're saying, John, and this is actually probably what I was trying to do, was I was giving her, I was grounding her in who she was. And until that point, you thought, who is this person who's having this experience? Then you knew she's someone who has had security because she and her mother have been incredibly close and have had quite a sort of basic life without all the sort of trappings of any kind of wealth, but they have had adventures and they've been quite open-minded. And they're sort of, in a way, they're people who care about people. And a lot of the people they find themselves with are people who care about having fun and are very ruthless. And so I was kind of giving her a little bit more of a background. But mm-hmm. I hope that she'll be all right. And I think that's probably where you get your clue from, although I hadn't known that that was the case.
Well, just the one contact with Mother in the book is the phone call to say I'm extending my visit. And it sounded such a typical worried mother saying, well, is everything all right? Or, you know, what aren't you telling me? As though that is the caring mother. It's certainly not a case of out of sight, out of mind. Because it seems to me that if you want to become optimistic, if somebody's going to be optimistic, they have to have something good inside of themselves to be able to, as I say, find the good out of the bad. And that seemed to be her early experiences, as you've said, Lara's earlier experiences. Now, the bad experience, as it were, here is death, and it's also sex. For Lara, it's the sexual encounter with Roland, all of which, of course, is set against this backdrop of the fairy tale, Diana getting married. Now, you've described this sexual encounter in a very particular way. The piece that you've read tells us something about Roland and his arrogance, you might say. But the rape and her behavior and his behavior, there's something very particular about that. Is there anything you wanted to illustrate by that?
I don't think Lara would ever call it a rape. And I'm not saying it's not one, but it would serve no purpose for her to do that, because then she'd have to confront it as that. So what I was trying really to show, to explore, was the kind of fine line of sexual encounters, particularly when you're young and you don't know exactly. It's hard to put into words. So much easier to write down. This is my experience, and so many, you know, young women I've spoken to, is that there's a point in your life where you don't really know what the rules are. You don't actually know what you are going to like. You don't want to be considered to be someone completely shut off from all experience. And so what I tried to describe with this episode, and I wrote it in various different ways over quite a long time, is that it's just a game that goes too far. But for a while, it's just a game. And what happens to her is that she's waiting for Kip and completely happy and confident in spending the night having a sexual experience with Kip when Roland creeps into her bed and starts to kind of bully her, you know, come on, you'll like it. Women are begging everywhere. And I think that it's so easy for people to just imagine that someone would go, you know, help, go away. But no, people are much too polite and much too embarrassed, at least a 17-year-old girl, in my experience, certainly I was, to do that, to be upfront. So you're like, oh, don't be silly, go away, you know, thinking it'll all be fine. And what I wanted to show in the writing of it was until the very, very moment that it isn't, she thinks that it will be.
Yeah.
And I wrote it, in fact, that it was all right, that she got away with it, was how I was thinking in my mind, that she got lucky. And I wrote it like that, and that was how it was going to be. And then one day, I just decided to see what would happen if I pushed it a bit further. And then I knew that that's what I had to do, because the other thing didn't really tell us anything we don't know. And I mean, some people probably construct their novels much more, with much more planning from the beginning, but I like that about writing, that you can set yourself some kind of puzzle in a way, and you can investigate it as you're doing it, because it makes it much more interesting as a writer. And actually at that point, I had these two versions, and I then wrote out, okay, if this does happen, what will happen in the rest of the book? And if it doesn't, what will happen in the rest of the book? And it was so much more infinitely more interesting what happened in the rest of the book. In fact, the plot was pretty much the same, but what was going on in her head, it meant that there was just a double... She was battling with something all the time for the whole rest of the book to either forget or remember or deal with or not deal with.
I will understand the adolescent experience of not knowing what the rules are, and therefore should you call out or shouldn't you, feeling shameful and so on. And I thought that was quite pivotal, actually, because later on, when she sees Kip having a sexual moment with Lulu, is it? And then it's as though the scales fall from her eyes, her Lara's eyes, as though, you see, that's the final moment when childhood falls away. You know, it isn't all just about dreams and fantasies and perfections, and that maybe you do have to protest, that life can be ugly, and she talks about that, doesn't she?
Mm.
The word ugly, and duplicitous. And then she does protest, because she says to Kip, stay off.
But she's angry with the wrong person.
She's angry with the wrong person, or with both people, should we say. But what struck me about the way you described that sexual scene with Roland was that it's actually a bit like there's something very primitive about it. It's like a hunter and a victim, isn't it? And it's slowly maneuvering and pinning down the object, which is... which seems to capture something about the primitiveness of the encounter.
Well, I always felt that Roland, you know, he's not a nice person, but ultimately he's stupid. So I just sort of gave him this sort of animal quality of arrogance mainly, but also stupidity. And I think he genuinely does believe, honestly, what a fuss. What a fuss. She will like it. Who doesn't like it? Sex, it's fantastic. What's the problem? She should be so lucky. And that's how he was thinking in my head.
Right. Sounds very persuasive. Now, death. You put that theme in as well. Presumably it's the death of childhood, the death of innocence, as it were. But there's also the death of Caroline. So this idea of putting death into this mix of love and sex, was that equally deliberate?
Equally undeliberate, in fact. I was thinking much more of it, much less of it being a theme than thinking about, in fact, around that age, I stayed with someone who was very ill and died not long after my visit. And it never occurred to me that that person would die. So what I was... For me, I was writing about Lara's inability to imagine, age 17, that anyone will ever die. That even, she, I mean, Lara, she doesn't really spend the time or take in that this woman that they've gone to visit, she doesn't realise that the reason why Lambert has, you know, broken his rule of never leaving his desk to go and spend 3 weeks in Italy is because his great old friend is dying. She just doesn't have those thoughts. And so I was really using that theme. I wasn't thinking, what will death bring to the story? I was thinking, just juxtaposing someone who's so much at the beginning of their life that they can't even imagine that the severity of someone's illness could ever lead to anything as final as death.
But it seems to me, out of death comes life, doesn't it? And the palio and all the atmosphere around that is about rebirth, isn't it? It's about the regeneration of life. And the people walking around with dummies in their mouths, I was very struck by that. So they're in touch with the sort of infantile nature of, you know, new life. Yeah, what you've already said, it wasn't planned, but it just seemed to me to capture something ideal about the passion and death and the new life.
It did seem amazingly lucky. I mean, I didn't know that much about the palio when I started writing the book, but as I got nearer to the point where the palio is going to happen in Siena during their three-week stay, there was absolutely no way I could avoid it. I did find myself thinking, oh, maybe they miss it, maybe, you know, Lambert's too ill, maybe they can't get there. I just knew that that was the most cowardly thought I could possibly have. And I went and researched it. And it's, I think when you start thinking about something that takes up so much of your thoughts, it's almost as if all the themes start to come together, because it is such an incredible symbol of rebirth. And they bring the earth to the square. And everything will be all right when the new earth is laid in the square. And I asked somebody when I actually went and saw the palio in order to write about it. I could never have written about it without seeing it. And I was really taken with these people walking around with giant dummies in their mouths. And I said, you know, what's the dummies about? What's going on? And he said, when the palio is run, Siena is reborn. We're all babies now. And I wasn't thinking, oh, this is just perfect. It themes into my book. But I knew that the whole thing was just absolutely perfect. I was so excited. And technically, it was incredibly difficult because they have such strong rules about absolutely everything that happens. And they took it so seriously. I was sort of, half of my brain was excited. The other half was terrified. How was I ever going to get it right enough to set it down without and never be allowed back into Italy? But it was actually the most challenging bit of the book to get.
And of course, it comes in the book towards the end, as though it's also somehow Lara's rebirth, you know, refinding herself, rather than just counting the days between her and the Roland experience, but that something come alive. So I also read it as something coming alive in her, that out of that bad experience, something good could arise.
Hmm.
The palio sort of represented that.
Not sure if you're pushing this too far now. I just don't know. Because in fact, at the palio is a sort of terrible moment, isn't there, where she is really confronted by her worst fear when she meets Andrew's Kip's father. So many things going on. But also, I just don't know. I have to think about that. I think that strangely, I feel that her kind of coming back to herself is when they actually leave Italy, maybe, and that she actually has a chance to sort of stop being so distracted by everybody else and is there back again with herself and her father and in fact what is reality, because it's hard to imagine that she will go on being involved with those people for the rest of her life, where she will go on being involved with her father.
Yes, there's nothing particularly appealing about any of those people, which in a sense makes her finding her father and finding something good out of the experience all the more sort of triumphant, really, because they're quite a decadent bunch, aren't they, really? I mean, they're just pleasure-seeking.
Mm.
It's not much depth.
Quite fickle, really, just because so many of them are so young. It's hard to imagine.
But they're no good relationships. Everybody's having an affair with somebody else.
There aren't any good role models. And the older generation are disastrous. And then the young ones are just, you know, impressed by all the wrong things, really. Although I was quite... it's hard if you're writing a very romantic story between two young people. I thought Kip was absolutely wonderful, but a lot of people have said he was, you know, hopeless and decadent. But it's only because I have to believe in that to write it and give Lara her passion for him.
Now, tell me about food. In that little piece you read out, I thought that's a perfect illustration of this person's very interested in food. I thought you shouldn't read this book if you're hungry. Mm. Because every time you turn a page, there's some description of a bit of mozzarella or a jam sandwich. Is food an interest in particular?
Well, it's really hard for me not to think of Italy without thinking of just the most delicious food I've ever eaten probably in my life. So I spent, you know, these years writing this book thinking about the food and just exactly the way it tasted in the sort of four or five times I've been to Italy and how incredibly delicious it is. But then I would have a break from writing and go down and look into my cupboard and think, and I'd take some sunflower seeds or something and an apple and take them back upstairs and never could be bothered to try and recreate any of the food. Because I love eating, but I can't be bothered to cook. So I know some people have read this book and imagined that I, you know, I'm a secret Nigella in the kitchen whipping up, you know, homemade pesto from the start. But no, I love writing about food, though.
Right.
Because it...
That comes across, yeah. Mm. But I thought it was because it adds to, you know, Italy, a land of romance, the sensuousness of the food, and her eating it. And of course, so again, I wondered if this was in the back of your mind, because she becomes a meat eater. And, you know, one could play on that as a statement about something. In the same, in a more flippant way, the only, she got sent out early to buy a sausage for her father. But,
oh,
you know,
my God.
That's sort of cliche observation. But the fact that... You know, do you see becoming a meat eater as sort of entering adult life, as it were?
No, I saw it that she was she wasn't confident enough to stick to her principles. That's where I was coming from, rather than she was, you know, delving into the carnivorous life. I just, you know, if you're young and you're a vegetarian and you go somewhere and they serve you, you know, some game and a couple of crisps, it's hard just to eat the crisps and to sit there. So it's just all so embarrassing. Mm-hmm. A lot of what I was investigating was just the sheer embarrassment of being 17. And so she thinks, I can't. They'll all think I'm so stupid if I say I'm a vegetarian. And so she just cuts into her steak, and it is the most delicious thing she's eaten in a very long time. Mm-hmm. And then she does feel like, oh, who am I? You know, I'm losing everything I believe in. But she has some more because she goes for it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Indeed.
But, you know, it's not that the other things don't exist. It's just that's where I'm thinking so much from her point of view all the time.
Yeah. Are there any questions you would have of an analyst about the book, about the characters?
I'm scared. If even the sausage is analysed, then...
Well, I did restrain myself for most of the time.
Oh, God. I mean, the strange, you know, when you write a book, you're so immersed in the emotional lives of your characters, or at least because I don't particularly write in a plot-driven way. I write in a character-driven way, an emotional-driven way. Then it's quite often only when you read the reviews that you really see what other people are seeing and the different levels of what you're saying, because I'm not making overall sort of layers. So what other, the way someone would analyze it in that way, it is really interesting and often a surprise, but actually something that you've known without being able to voice it all the time.
Mm-hmm.
I find if I know too much about what I'm doing, I actually find it harder to write about it because I sort of know it. And someone once asked me in a situation like this, do you know why you're writing? Do you know what you're trying to say? No. No, I don't suppose I do. And they went, that's good, because if you did, you wouldn't bother to write. And I think that's true if you know too much. Sometimes I have a really, really brilliant idea for a story, and I, you know, have all of the bits, but because I have it all, there's no point writing it. Usually I like to have, like, three really good bits, mm-hmm. and then just be totally intrigued at how I can make it work with the other unknown bits.
Well, that actually parallels analysis and the work we do, in as much as if people come prepared and know exactly what they want to say, it's a bit of a waste of time. One's much more interested in just things evolving and flowing, where the person isn't quite sure what they're going to say either. They discover something new. Hopefully I can help them discover something further about that. But it parallels writing in a sense. It's sort of a free association.
And, you know, because I use certain things from my life and memories, then it's interesting, the ones that absolutely stick. And you think, well, why did I remember exactly that little moment in all the others I must have forgotten? And so, you know, you can spend time thinking about that. But that, what's lovely about being a writer is they are so useful. Something that may not have been wonderful at the time would be fantastically useful because it's so vivid, and then you can create something else out of it.
Well, we often use a term called a screen memory, as though something like that which you might remember acts as a screen, and so things which are behind it, which maybe one can find more about. Just before we go over to the audience, I've got another quote to read, and I'd like to get your response to this. This is from Samuel Johnson. The true aim of writing is to enable the reader better to enjoy life, or better to endure it.
The true aim of reading.
The true aim of writing.
Of writing.
This is you, of course, you the writer, is to enable the reader better to enjoy life or better to endure it. I suppose really what's behind the question is simply, do you have an aim in writing? Or is it merely to make sense of your own experience? Or do you want to bring something to your readers so they can identify, so they can grow, so they can understand themselves? Do you have any aims in writing?
In a word, no. It is really interesting because I was doing a reading with two other writers, Edna O'Brien and Rachel Cusk, and we were all asked this question, and the answers were just so different. But my selfish aim in writing is entirely selfish. I'm doing it because it's just my greatest pleasure and joy, and fascinates me to make something. It's like I can feel that I'm actually almost making something out of clay, you know, forming it. And if I think about the reader, which I do, occasionally I write something, I think, oh, someone will like that. They'll think it's funny. I think, stop it, don't. It never helps. It doesn't help the reader, because what I'm writing will be rubbish. It doesn't help me. And it just makes me self-conscious. And the only thing that I do think about the reader is how much I love to read. I'm primarily a reader. You know, I've been reading long before I started writing. It's just, I love to read. I think if I couldn't have a book with me, I didn't know what I would do. You know, to go abroad or to go on a journey without a book actually quite scares me. You know, it just is my safety blanket totally.
Yep.
And so then I think, well, I'm providing a book for people because they've provided them for me. But I have to say, I don't think about it. Whereas, I can't remember what Edna O'Brien said, but Rachel Cusk amazed me by saying she felt she was, she was sacrificing her life. Sorry, it sounds awful, but it was fascinating. You know, in the service of, you know, bringing books to people. It wasn't like she wanted to do it or she thought she was any good at it. She was doing it because people needed books and that's what she chose. Whereas I felt that they're sacrificing their lives reading my books because I'm just so grateful to be doing the thing I love most. I feel very lucky.
Good. We've had our 50 minutes.
Wow.
Well, I did let it go on for the 50 minutes. I think it's just an automatic timing device that is embedded in my soul. But we can now open it up to the audience for questions and comments and have a lively discussion with both Esther and with John.